You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Because there's nothing like a weekend pause with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Warning, this podcast contains spoilers for The Flash and some theories for Secret Invasion. Hello, my name is Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Rosie Knight.
And welcome back after our short break to X-Ray Vision, the Crooked Media podcast, where we dive deep into your favorite shows, movies, comics, and pop culture.
We missed you. We're glad you're back.
We did.
In this episode, previously on, I'm going to give you a little refresher on The Flash's journey through production hell and obviously the controversies around its star, Ezra Miller. In the airlock, we're going to talk about The Flash. It's time. And then we got a double omnibus for you. We're going to be covering the two comics that are going to be inspiring all the stuff we're talking about, Flashpoint, and then to prepare for Secret Invasion, which is hitting on the day you will hear this podcast. Jason's written an incredible omnibus on Secret Invasion. In the Nerd Out, an MCU multiverse query from Homer.
Ooh, coming up previously on. Okay, first up, some background context for The Flash, a very troubled production focusing on the issues surrounding star Ezra Miller. First of all, I saw this film this weekend in the theater, as one, I guess, should.
I, too, saw it in the theater.
And I'm excited to talk about our thoughts, but I will say, I guess because of how pointedly troubled the production has been, I was kind of surprised that this is better than Black Adam. I enjoyed some parts of it. I'll just leave it there. That's what I'll say.
I will say my general takeaway is it wasn't a film that was for me, but there were some moments where I was kind of blown away by the artistry and the good things.
Yeah.
That came out of this movie that I think was, like you said, very troubled.
Okay, so where do you even start with the Ezra Miller situation? Miller has been involved in a litany of legal issues, starting with an arrest and an accusation of grooming a teenager. These exploits include trespassing, choking a woman in Iceland in an incident that has been caught on camera, and other issues dating back to 2020. And these issues at the time seemed to pose a potentially mortal threat to the Flash production. I think you and I both opined that there was no way that this movie could go forward. And yet it has gone forward.
Yeah, I think once you see the movie and you understand that Ezra is on screen for 99% of the film, you understand the quandary on a business sense that Warner Brothers was in, even though they never seemed to have a moral quandary about it. I still find it quite shocking that this film came out and there has not been more conversation about the work that Ezra has hopefully done to kind of hopefully make themselves better, make the people they harmed better. I feel like it's quite strange there kind of hasn't been a PR campaign or a conversation around that. But also this movie probably cost around $300 million. So I understand that for Warner, it's a business choice.
Yeah, that was part of the conversation we were having off mic. Obviously, in the Discovery era, the David Zaslav era, Warner Discovery has been making a lot of waves by its unilateral canceling of projects that were in the works and its memory holing of various content that was on the HBO Max platform.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this in order to basically create write downs so that they could cut some of the enormous debt that Discovery has taken on in its leveraged purchase of Warner Brothers. So, from that perspective, I agree with you. I don't know how they could have not done this film from a we need to cut the debt perspective. This movie cost, I think the reported number is somewhere south of
220.
Yeah, south of 300 million. But like, there's a lot of scuttlebutt that it cost anywhere up to $500 million, like
especially including marketing and the many, many reshoots. Also, I think we will get into this more in both the conversation about The Flash and also in my Flashpoint omnibus, but
yeah,
it's really interesting. I was in a comic shop in Palm Springs, one of my local comic shops that I love. I love that shop, Comics Asylum, Palm Springs. I was talking to the owner, and all she wanted was to see Grant Gustin in a Flash movie.
Yeah.
And so many people have said that to me. They've gone, I don't understand why they made this movie with Ezra or why they didn't just get Grant. Like, so many wide audience.
There was a moment that I thought he was going to be in it, but we'll continue with that.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more. But basically, the other side of this, aside from the Ezra of it all, which is the kind of, I feel like, the thing that has really been weighing heavy on us and on many of the audience, like, morally and kind of ethically, is like, this seems like it's being brushed over. But even before Ezra was even attached, this movie has had an absolutely wild journey through production.
Yeah, let's go through it.
Let's go through it. So I just want to shout out Maya, who is our crooked intern, because this is an unbelievable, like, 20 years that she had to flip through it. But look, it starts with our old friend David Goyer, writes a Flash script in 2007 with Wally West as the lead. I would love to see it. It was one of the things that we suggested could have been done to fix this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Barry Allen is a supportive character, but he's the first creative to leave for creative difference. Now, you will see that that is a recurring theme. Same year, Sean Levy's hired to oversee the film. After less than a year, he leaves due to his conflicts with his other film, Night at the Museum.
And then we should add that this was a period in which, first of all, DC theoretically riding high due to the success of Batman Begins, script written by David Goyer,
yeah,
directed by Christopher Nolan, of course. But this was also a period when the conversation around DC was that the leadership of the comics creative leadership was heavily micromanaging films and had a very, very particular angle, and like conflicts like this would often arise.
Yeah. And also remember, this is pre-Iron Man.
Right.
So there's no MCU. We have Batman Begins. That's a game changer. And it reimagines the way that superhero movies can be. And it also puts DC on the map for the first time for a critically acclaimed live action movie in quite a few years, where they'd already been smashing it with the animated stuff. But it was a very interesting time. And so end of December 2007, you still have two more people who will be attached. David Dobkin. He's going to do a spin-off of Justice League Mortal, which is one of the most legendary never made movies. And that would have cast Adam Brody as Barry Allen. Now, I would personally have loved to see this. This is George Miller's very famously never made Justice League movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you were going to have like DJ Katrona as Clark Kent, Jay Baruchel as Maxwell Lord. Like, this is one of those most famous kind of it never got made movies. And of course, you would have had Adam Brody then as this lead of the Flash movie. But that didn't happen. Justice League Mortal gets canceled within the same year. Flash continues on with a 2008 release date. Then 2007-2008 WGA strike further delays the Flash film production. Then Charles Roven is brought on to produce with a new treatment by Geoff Johns, but the film is never greenlit. 2010, Green Lantern writers, remember that beloved movie? Greg Berlanti, obviously now like the helmer of a lot of
the guy, yeah.
The guy that we know from so many DC projects, especially if you watch the TV show, Michael Green and Mark Guggenheimer developed. They're going to make Green Lantern 2. That didn't happen. And The Flash, October 7th, 20. Yeah, I mean, you listen to that.
Right here is the period when Geoff Johns, noted Geoff Johns, well-known comics writer, creator, and executive at DC, was elevated to chief creative officer and really began an influential and some would say troubled run.
Definitely. And also, so 2010, that's when we're last looking at this. We were just talking about, you know, Green Lantern 2, The Flash. Flashpoint happened in 2011, which Geoff Johns was the writer of with the artist Adam Kubert.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2011, Green Lantern came out and flopped. So you'll notice that there is no talk for another 4 years. And that is October 7th, 2014. That's when The Flash show begins. Grant Gustin starring on the CW. And that becomes the way that many audiences learn about The Flash, learn about the Speed Force, learn about the multiverse. 2014, Ezra Miller is cast as The Flash. So that's how long this movie, you're talking 9 years from when Ezra was cast and when Ezra actually played the Flash and the movie came out. So that's a seriously long time in production. Obviously, Ezra is planned to appear in Justice League. That happens. And then a 2018 solo film, which we now know didn't come out till 2023. Mm-hmm. So here we start just with the production troubles on this film. You have Seth Graham Smith hired to write and direct The Flash. Story developed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller. Seth Graham departs in 2016. Creative differences. Now, this is the most famous one and the one I wish we could have seen, which is Rick Famuyiwa, who obviously we now know is the unbelievable powerhouse behind some of the best episodes of The Mandalorian. He's hired to replace it. Then we get Cyborg's hired in Justice League and apparently is going to play a big role in the Flash solo film, which makes a lot of sense because this was when people started to realize, oh, this is a Flashpoint movie. And as we will talk about,
right,
in the Flashpoint universe, there is no Superman, but Cyborg is essentially the Superman of the universe. So it's really important to have him in that role. Famuyiwa leaves, 2016. 2017, writer Joby Harold is hired to write a new take. 2017, San Diego Comic-Con, it's revealed the Flash will be an adaptation of Flashpoint.
Important to note that at this time, Infinity War and Endgame are... Infinity War was 2018, Endgame was 2019. Peak Marvel happening right now, and DC under extreme pressure to be like, where's your shared universe?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where Flashpoint comes in because it is the hinged movie that would create the next level shared universe on top of Justice League stuff.
It's actually really wild to think about it now. We've seen The Flash, and you, if you're listening to this, have probably seen The Flash or you've read about it. It's kind of mind-blowing because you're absolutely right. Flashpoint was supposed to be their Endgame. It was supposed to be their Infinity War. It was supposed to be all of those mixed into one, as well as their Avengers. It was going to be that huge crossover movie that everything had been leading to after Justice League, after Batman versus Superman. And it was supposed to explode the world out and introduce anyone that you wanted or bring in new people. And that obviously is not the direction it went. And in the end, we ended up in a situation where this is the end of the DCEU rather than kind of an expansion of it. 2018, Game Night Helmers, John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, who we are big fans of. They wrote the Dungeons and Dragons movie. They wrote Homecoming.
Yeah.
They were in talks to make a Flash movie and it was going to be very Back to the Future influenced.
That influence is still there.
Well, yeah. If you see, they're the ones who actually have the first story credit on the movie.
Yep.
Because they obviously took a lot from that. So then Back to the Future, like we said, we saw it. The Flash movie's delayed in 2018. It was meant to come out in 2018, but because of the Fantastic Beasts movie, it's delayed. Then Ezra spoke about how they were working with comic book icon Grant Morrison on this kind of darker take of The Flash, which was going to be something they were going to pitch that would be a different story, which makes a lot of sense. Grant's done some of the best cosmic multiversal comic book writing. Daly and Goldstein leave because of creative differences, 2019. Seeing a pattern here. Andy Muschietti is hired to replace them with Christina Hodson, who wrote Birds of Prey, which I love, as the new writer. Then the movie's going to come out July 1st, my birthday, 2022. Didn't happen. But in 2020, we did get a big moment that really felt like DC was doing something Marvel had not done yet, which was when Ezra's version of The Flash showed up in the Flash TV show during one of their big crisis events and met Grant's Flash. And it was like, whoa, this is actually happening. And then we hit April 6, 2020, and that video of Ezra choking the woman in Iceland, which they claimed was a joke, just to put both sides out there. But that interaction goes online, and then we start into that Ezra era. And everything else is more well-known. 2020, Michael Keaton's going to be in Batman. You know, Ben Affleck's Bruce Wayne will be in the film. And we start to get to where we know a little bit more about the movie.
Now, the period in that we just outlined, which leads us up to the James Gunn era right now,
mm-hmm,
was a period of executive turnover at DC. And I think you can read that through the various...
So many regimes.
So many regimes, a lot of pocket regimes. TV didn't talk to film, didn't talk to animation. They all had these little, like, fiefdoms. And I think what you're seeing is, with all the creative differences, is the result of that. You bring in a director or a writer, right? And you say, what's your take?
Mm-hmm.
We love it. Go forward. The regime changes above the writer. Now, all of a sudden, that executive has a different angle,
mm-hmm,
or has a different creative team that they want to work with. They have notes, things that were agreed upon previously are no longer agreed upon because you've got different parties involved, creative differences. And this is happening over and over and over again, which is what you get in situations like this.
It's kind of mind-blowing. Like, I feel like even me and you, we tell stories now in these spaces and we kind of are students of Hollywood and this industry. But when you're outside of it, even, and when you're even a little bit inside of it the way I am, it kind of blows your mind how much this stuff is chosen on a whim. I interviewed Alex Winter from Bill and Ted, like one of my favorite movies, right? But he was talking about Freaked, which is this cult movie that he made, real practical effects, very beloved, weird cult movie. It was gonna be this huge teen-focused smash for the studio because this one exec loved it. And he thought it was so good and it was so weird, and they were gonna do Levi's commercials and Pepsi commercials. And he left, and the new exec who came in went to a screening in like somewhere in the South Bay, sat at the back, saw these kids like losing their mind, like behaving real rowdy, and just was like, the movie's not coming out, and just shelved it because he just didn't get it. And that's like, that's the difference between you can have your champion. And this is not, we're not even talking about huge IP here. This is an original, weird, like cult practical effects movie. But that's how much of a whim this stuff can be. And obviously, when you're talking about The Flash or something that's so much money, that's a whole different level of control that the regime wants.
Here's a good example. And this is kind of off topic, but it's kind of on topic. I don't know what the case is now, but a period of time, AMC was, because of the corporate ownership of the channel AMC, the home of Mad Men and Breaking Bad, James Dolan, the owner of the New York Knicks and, you know, CEO of Cablevision once upon a time, executive at Live Nation and various other things, had the ability to like thumbs up or thumbs down like cuts of Mad Men.
Oh my gosh.
And so there would be times where, this is just like stuff I've heard, where Mad Men be like waiting to see, like, oh, can we do this? Like, is this cut okay? Or, like, are we going to get a season two? And they're basically waiting for, like, James Dolan to be like, yeah, sure, fine. And one of the things that James Dolan wanted was to have his band's music involved in some show at AMC, which ended up being Hell on Wheels. I don't know if people remember the Western show that James eventually did get his band's music on, but that was one of the things like he was trying to do. And it just goes to show you how like personalities of execs absolutely influence all the things that you see.
Mm-hmm.
And we imagine that, oh, this is part of a strategic vision and and there's a reason. No, sometimes like a person just is like, I want to put this in there. Okay, now we got to do this. And that's just what happens.
And I do think that that is relevant here, especially because like not only because of all these different iterations that we're talking about that almost became The Flash, but also just, and obviously there is a monetary element of this and we will talk about this more, but even the fact that David Zaslav as the exec saw Batgirl, didn't like it and said, this isn't worth releasing. And then saw The Flash and said, well, I think this is great. And we spent a lot of money about it. So we're going to throw all our money into that and take the write down on Batgirl. Even there is that once again, like subjective choice on quality, as well as many, many dollars and business kind of things coming into it too. But it's really interesting.
Perversely, David Zaslav has become something of a pioneer in the realm of write downs, because once he started taking programs off of his platforms, other platforms have followed suit.
Yeah, Disney Plus,
Netflix, Hulu, etc. Disney Plus, various other platforms are also taking shows off of their system in order to take the write down, not have to pay the creators, and basically lower their debt bill going forward as Wall Street continues to hammer streaming. Now that we've talked about that, let's talk about the movie.
Crooked is raising money for Vote Save America's Fuck Bans, Leave Queer Kids Alone funds, supporting organizations on the ground in states that are banning care and targeting trans youth. Our original goal was 50K, but you are all so amazing and have crushed that already. So now we're doubling it to 100K. You can donate to either political impact organizations or tax-deductible nonprofits, or both. Head to votesaveamerica.com/fuckbans to learn more and donate today.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait!
did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary. Indulges your senses, and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.
We're stepping out of the airlock and into Central City for The Flash in theaters now. Rosie, your thoughts?
I was very happy to see Kiersey Clemons back as Iris West. I love that casting. I hated what they did with her in Justice League. I still didn't think she got enough here, but I love to see it. That was my happiest thing to see. Other positive notes that I had. Andy Muschietti, that's a man who can direct a Batman. I understand why they gave him Brave and the Bold. You know what it is, okay, and I'm sure we're going to agree on this, but like, let's not get to the babies yet. We'll leave the babies, the gummy babies,
God,
the CG babies.
Jesus,
we'll leave
the
them
babies
for a minute. Let's start on something positive.
The much maligned on social CG.
Renesmee sibling babies. But like, you know what? This is a movie which somehow, I don't know how this happened, but it did. This is one of the truest impacts this movie had on me. I felt sad that we didn't get to see more Ben Affleck Batman. This Ben Affleck Batman who gives him that speech, who tells him our scars make us who we are. You can't take that away. The Batman who is wearing a Dark Knight Returns cowl that looks like it was drawn by Frank Miller and inked by Klaus Janson and colored by Lynn Varley. And he's on the motorbike and he's zooming through the city with this kind of soaring score. I thought they should have won. They should have started the movie there. No babies. But also like that to me, I was like, oh, I was like, okay, either Ben Affleck was like, this is my last chance, so I'm going to kill it. Or he was never given the material to do something special. Because it made me feel like, oh, I would have liked to see this version of Batman. Him and Keaton, they were the highlights for me, no question.
I feel the same way. I thought the cast as well was great. It was wonderful to see Maribel Verdú from Tambien as Barry's mom. I thought that it was a better film than I thought it was going to be. Like, I thought it was pretty good, actually. Certainly better than Black Adam. I thought there were elements of the emotional beats that actually kind of worked for me. To your point, the relationship with Michael Keaton Batman, with Batman 1989, was really, I thought, pretty fun, actually. That being said, there was one moment that really, like, record scratched for me.
Yes.
And it's, like, 8 minutes into the film, Barry, after, you know, he's got to do this little thing to kind of help Batman out. This is where the babies comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And on his way out, he's, like, interacting with some people on the street. And then he says to them something about, I'm going to kind of botch this, but paraphrasing, he mentions something about mental health and how important it is. And he says that's something that the Justice League hasn't figured out yet, which clearly to me,
I mean, they basically do a wink to camera. It's so like,
it felt like a self-referential, hey, we know you're kind of aware of Ezra's issues and we are too. And we just wanted to acknowledge that. That's the only way it makes sense for the inclusion of this in there. And it just felt really tenured to me. Like, I don't know that this is a thing to make fun of.
That to me was when I just turned on the movie. Like, I couldn't help it. Like, the CG babies, I like weird, outrageous stuff, but the
CG, Ezra, I mean,
it's like the Ezra of it all was always going to be hard for me.
Yeah.
But I was like, you know what? I'm going to go into it. I'm going to hope that they're doing the work they need to do. I'm going to hope that Dakota Ionize is somewhere out there safe and being looked after. And I'm just going to try and watch the movie and think about the movie and think about the comics and all the people who made this movie possible, all the thousands of people who worked on it. And the CGI babies, I was like, this is objectively terrible. And I kind of love that many studio people and Tom Cruise somehow thought this was possible. And yeah. I kind of like, it almost like passes into camp that people were talking about this being the greatest movie of all time. And there's like CGI babies being put in microwaves. But then when they did this like nod, nod, wink, wink joke.
Yeah, I didn't like that.
It was quite gross. And also for me, I was like, is this a joke about how Warner Brothers like didn't help Ezra, because they're like, the Justice League is still working on that, and the implication is like, well, Ezra didn't get that help,
right?
It was really gross, and I know they must have done that on a reshoot. There's just no way that joke would have been in there before.
Well, either way, right, I thought about this too. Let's say it was in the original,
cut it out.
The decision to leave it in is clearly one that is based on a acknowledgement of Ezra's legal issues in the real world, because that's the only, surely people flag that line as Ezra's shit was unfolding and somebody would have gone, do we want to do this? And I think the decision to go, if indeed it was in the original script, to go forward with it is like, hey, let's say that we get it. It's like Tom Wamsgans, you know, we hear for you. It's kind of, it feels like a we hear for you.
It is a big Succession move.
It feels like, hey, let's show people that we get it. We understand we know we're not sticking our heads in the sand. We understand that you've heard all about this, and we want to let you know that we hear for you. Oh. And we understand that's the only way that you go forward with this. And it just felt really weird to me.
It's really weird. And also it's Ezra talking to camera. So it's, the joke is to the audience well.
Like, it was very, very strange.
I was not a big fan. And then luckily they distracted me with the Batman. That kind of comes up next, you know, get to see Jeremy Irons again as Alfred, which I think is such a brilliant casting. Like, love that. So yeah.
You spoke about Andy. I want to talk about Andy Muschietti, director of It. He's supposed to direct Brave and the Bold, as you mentioned.
That's the apology movie, right?
Yes.
Allegedly.
I don't know this for a fact, but I will say that I think when you get a person who comes in and is a good soldier, right, and takes on a absolutely haunted, cursed poltergeist production that is beset by wild issues with its star that cannot be replaced because they are in essentially every shot of the movie.
Every single shot.
I would say
every
96%
frame
of the movie they are in. I think you got to let him do Brave and the Bold. And I think he did a really good job.
This was a great audition for Batman.
CG issues aside, and listen, I don't like the CG. Was it weird? Yes. I thought there were some weird design choices. Obviously, people worked extremely hard on the CG.
And they did, according to Andy Muschietti, that was a design choice. So I just want to say, I think it was the wrong choice, but this was not a case, allegedly, according to the studio, which, you know, take it with a pinch of salt. This was allegedly a choice rather than a crunch issue or a timing issue. So people worked really hard to do what the studio asked them to make it look this way.
You know, chaos spreads and it influences everything. And we've got a production that is this chaotic. It's not perhaps surprising that some of it would reach the screen. And it's, I guess, you know, your mileage may vary if you perceive the shortcomings in the CG to be an effect of that chaos. But I will say the fact that so little of that chaos reached the screen is a credit to everyone who worked on the film and Andy. Like, that, good job, because it's incredible that you made a cohesive film out of that. Now, the Batman. I also loved the Batman. I thought the Batman were great. Yeah. A small change here in which Michael Keaton, unlike in Flashpoint, plays Bruce Wayne, alternate version Bruce Wayne, not Thomas Wayne.
I do want to say that was a big question I had.
Same.
Why not just be Thomas Wayne? I don't get it. I understand they wanted it to be like, it's 1989 Batman. But that, I will say, in the canon, causes a problem, because if you did not know this. Now, I want to say, I feel like if you listen to this podcast, you think that I'm like a huge Arrowverse stan. That is not the case. The Arrowverse has been very hit and miss for me, but I appreciate the impact it had on
Same.
accessibility for comic book stories.
Yes.
You know, we had like the Legends of Tomorrow. That's a show I've actually watched all of and thought was really brilliant, especially from like the third season on. But generally, not a huge like passion of mine, aside from the impact it had. But in the canon of the original Flash series, the original Arrow series, those are set in the same world as Keaton's 1989. Like, there are references to that. That was always the way it was meant to be. So this then again brings up that canon issue of where is Barry if this is the same universe. I did think it was really interesting that he wasn't playing Thomas. I think that would have been an easy,
fun fix.
I don't think it would have taken away from the nostalgia because it's still Keaton. And I just think it would have been cool.
I think the idea is, you know, look no further than... and Fast X for a film in which decisions are made that you then get locked into for a franchise.
Yes,
I think they didn't want to lock into a world in which Michael Keaton is Thomas Wayne forever in case they want to bring him back,
mm-hmm.
or a world in which he's Thomas Wayne and then all of a sudden he's Bruce Wayne and you kind of have to explain it to the audience.
Playing it to people, yeah. That
makes a lot of sense. I think this was the path of least resistance, and I get it. Let's talk about the babies. Okay, so the CG.
Okay.
So Andy has been asked about the babies. There's a spoiler. Mm-hmm. There's a sequence early in the film in which Batman, Ben Affleck Batman, needs the Flash's help, and he's called everyone else, but they're all busy, and so Barry has to go help Batman, and he has to save all these babies from this hospital that is, like, crumbling into a sinkhole. And the babies look... bizarre. I don't like, there's no way, they look very, very strange, like overly smoothed and with...
If you've seen Twilight, they look like the baby from Twilight. They over-emote. They are very obviously fake. And they look, I will say this is fair, I think from Andy's said it's supposed to look this way. So, I mean, they look like scratch. They don't look like it's finished. A lot of people who saw this at CinemaCon, etc., was like, this isn't the finished version. Like, obviously it's going to be, and a lot of the preview screenings, people thought that it wasn't going to be the finished version. And that was kind of the messaging that they were hearing or that they were sharing. I think that was more just like their presumption because of the way it looked. But that was, if you go on Letterboxd, a lot of people who saw the preview screenings in the lead up to the release were like, obviously this isn't the finished version. It can't be. It's the same version they were showing at CinemaCon. It's the same version. This was a choice. I don't understand it.
Well, Andy...
Yeah, say Andy, because I think this is very interesting.
Yeah, here's his quote. The idea, of course, is we are in the perspective of the Flash. So when Flash is accessing the Speed Force and using his powers, what Andy is then saying is you're seeing things as the Flash sees them. So he continues, quote, everything is distorted in terms of light and textures. We enter this water world, which is basically being in Barry's POV. It was part of the design, so if it looks a little weird to you, that was intended.
I hate to be a guy who is picking apart this answer because I love the commitment here to supporting the vision. I think it's I think it's really cool to support the CGI artists like this. Like, this has not turned into some chaotic Marvel-esque fallout, even though, as many people have pointed out, and I don't disagree, I do think the CG in this is worse than the CG in Ant-Man Quantumania by like quite a far reach.
I think that's accurate.
But like, so I will say something here, because this quote specifically, my understanding is about the CG in general, and very specifically, one of the things that this movie does. Okay, I'm going to do like a one sentence description of the movie. So if you haven't seen it, you don't understand. Barry goes back in time to save his mom. To do that, he accesses something that in the movie they call the Chrono Bowl, which in the comics we would call the Cosmic Treadmill.
Right.
And that is where he essentially accesses the Speed Force and he finds an area that looks kind of like a zoetrope, you know, the old way they used to show movies and moving images. And in there, he can travel through time. Now, doing that causes a new timeline. That's where he meets Batman. That's where he meets Sasha Carl's Supergirl. Zod comes back and they have to defeat them together. And eventually he has to go back, fix it, let his mom die, and the movie's over. So that's what happens. But the Chrono Bowl is the big issue with CG, in my opinion. And this is what Andy's talking about. Because when you go in there, it looks like a Sims game.
It does. That, to me, was weirder than the babies, the Chrono Bowl, because it's so much info.
And you're in there so much.
It looks like you know what it looks like to me? It looked like an iTunes screensaver.
Exactly.
Like a visualizer.
It looks like a visualizer, but instead of nice, calming images, it is people.
Right.
And moments from the film, but rendered in CG.
It's like a horrifying mushroom trip.
Yes, it's a horrifying mushroom trip, and you spend a lot of the movie in there, and you wish that you didn't. So I think Andy's defense and explanation of the CG works in that framework, because you are in the Chrono Bowl, is in Barry's perspective. But I will say, at the beginning, even when Barry is not in the Speed Force and he's pulling a baby out of the microwave in the normal time, the baby still look fucked up.
I will also say that, listen, again, the effects people worked very hard on this, I'm sure. But I think that it's not uncommon for reshoots, particularly VFX reshoots, to like be happening late in the game. I'm sure at a certain point when you're already over budget, potentially hitting the $500 million mark, a lot of that is going to your star because of their litany of very, very serious legal issues.
Yeah.
At a certain point, it's like, that's where all the money goes. You know what I mean? Like, you're just not, hey, do we have X amount to like do some tweaks on the Chrono Bowl? No.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that that happened, but it feels like that's probably what happened.
I don't see a world where you spend 4 years making this movie and visualizing this movie and crafting these big fight scenes and these emotional beats, and you see the Chrono Bowl and you think, yeah, people are gonna love that. Like, that's gonna sell our story. I don't see it. I was constantly pretty shocked every time we were in there that was a choice.
It was so weird.
And yeah, it was not something that worked visually for me, and it definitely gave me the feeling of like a 2000s like cutscene from like a PC game.
Yeah, it's very The Mummy.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely Scorpion King energy.
Yeah. Now, there were elements of this movie that I really liked. Again, Batman I liked. Supergirl, Sacha Calle, I thought was
great. Wish she'd been in it more.
I did. Here's an issue where you feel like, okay, here's where they ran out of money for stuff. Spoiler. The battle against Zod just kind of, what happened? I don't know. Did we win? Did we not win?
I think you didn't win.
I think the Flash just left.
The Flash left, and then Supergirl gets murdered.
In my mind's eye, as I recall this, it's very kind of ambiguous as what that happens with that big battle. It just kind of like peters out.
Okay. I think this is the biggest issue for me for this movie compared to, say, a movie like Venom, Let There Be Carnage, right? Now, look, we both had a lot of fun, like, talking about how crazy that movie was and how it was this like...
I like a weird movie.
But I'm going to tell you, yeah? Venom, Let There Be Carnage, that is 90 minutes of pure entertainment. The pacing never stops. You know what's happening. You know who wins. You know who loses. I will tell you guys something. If you haven't seen The Flash, the first hour, there are no other main characters than two Ezra Millers playing Barry Allen. It is an hour until Michael Keaton comes into the movie. And then you meet Sacha Calle. And then there is a battle with Zod. I feel like the pacing in this movie it didn't work for me. And the Zod battle is part of it. Now I'm going to tell you the biggest issue, I think, with all of this, aside from the stuff we've talked about, CG, Ezra. The biggest issue is, this is a Flashpoint movie where over the years they have been told or they have chosen to not adapt Flashpoint. And that is the problem. There are multiple issues here. The Zod battle, it basically becomes irrelevant because Barry has to come into conflict with his younger self. And then they have to go to the Chrono Bowl and have the real battle, which is between Barry and what they call Dark Flash, which is Barry's younger self who's been stuck in the Chrono Bowl.
This is where I thought Grant Gustin was
would have loved to see it.
Yeah,
But like, the problem is, as we will talk about in the Flashpoint Omnibus, they miss the cyclical nature and the holistic story of the Flash. You cannot have the Flash without the Reverse Flash. There is a very now quite infamous interview or quote from Andy Muschietti where somebody says, so who killed Barry's mom? And he says, well, I guess it was Reverse Flash. What do you mean you guess? Like, that doesn't make you can't. It was Reverse Flash. That's what happens in the comics. But like, in the movie, there is an ambiguity here.
They kind of do the Reverse Flash thing in which
they call it the Dark Flash, but it's like, but that's not who killed Barry's mom. That's young Flash who gets stuck in the Speed Force.
Right. But I'm saying they kind of do their version of the kills Barry's mom is that Dark Flash pushes Barry out of the Chrono Bowl, causing him to enter the world in which Barry, who will become Dark Flash, gets his powers because that's the world where no superheroes are.
And that's kind of, again, is like this loose adaptation, whereas in Flashpoint, you learn that Reverse Flash knocked Barry out of the Speed Force because he wanted to create himself into like a paradox that Barry would never be able to create himself.
Right.
Yeah. And he wanted to create a paradox world where Barry could never kill him and he could exist without Barry because he's never been able to exist without Barry. I felt like the lack of the easy linear storyline of Flashpoint, which is kind of this, it's a line, but it's a circle and everything's connected. That to me was one of the weirdest things. Like, there's no conversation here about who the Reverse Flash is, why they want to kill Barry's mom, what that has to do with anything. We end up with this dark, you know, I hate that where the dark stuff is evil, but we end up with Dark Flash instead of Reverse Flash. And that comes at the end, and they haven't really been a conflict throughout. Zod doesn't get defeated. He just kills Supergirl and leaves, leaving him open, I guess, to be a different villain. But I feel like that third act struggles from those choices to not just directly adapt Flashpoint.
I understand why they made a lot of these choices, but I think one of the things that I think is really cool about Flashpoint, the comic, is that, like, it just drops Barry into a world where, like, his mom is alive. Like, he's just at work, and then his mom is there. And he's like, wait, I think you're dead.
This is it.
I thought that because I think some of the heaviest lifting that this movie does is the work to make you care about Barry's parents. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of work in one movie, like you don't see them previously. And I think your mileage may vary again, and I'm not a big time Hollywood writer director, but I do think it would have been quicker and faster, sorry for the pun, to just drop Flash. Flash wakes up and his mom's alive. And what the fuck is going on? What happened? And now he's got to try and figure it out.
I think that is the best thing, because as we'll get into in Flashpoint, the biggest mystery in Flashpoint is who is to blame for changing the
how
timeline.
How did this happen?
And you assume it's Reverse Flash, and you fight, Barry teams up with Thomas Wayne, and they're fighting this great villain. And then as this movie reveals in the first 15 minutes, it's Barry. And that was a huge game-changing reveal that felt so shocking. And I think if this film had trusted the audience a bit more and allowed them to go on that journey, have that mystery, and have Barry have that realization, maybe even they would have wanted to blame it on Dark Flash instead of Barry. I think there's a version of that that would have worked. I think the half Flashpoint of it all is part of why it didn't necessarily connect. I saw a lot of people online who didn't understand why Thomas Wayne wasn't in it, who didn't understand why the Aquaman and Wonder Woman storylines weren't even like vaguely adapted from the comic. I think the legend of it being a Flashpoint adaptation had lived longer than the reality.
Yeah, I do think very clearly there was, you know, Ray Fisher, who's had his own issues
especially within the Warner Brothers studio system.
Within the Warner Brothers studio system, was supposed to be in this. Cyborg plays a pretty big part in the Flashpoint comic. We won't spoil that for you. We're going to talk about that later. My sense was there was a very clear direction to move away from the Snyderverse as briskly as possible with this film. Once events in the wider Warner ecosystem happen with Snyder moving on and the whole Snyder Cut thing happening and Fisher's fallout. So I think, you know, again, here's the real world intruding on the stuff you see on the screen. The reason they're not in it is because it's unclear like how much of that stuff is going to carry over into what James Gunn is doing.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I guess like as we come to kind of the end of the movie, which we haven't really talked about, the big thing that everyone was talking about, that kind of comes into it even more, because originally, from the reporting that has come out, and the original ending would have seen Barry fix the Speed Force, fix the timeline, and at the end, Michael Keaton's Batman and Sasha Carl would have been there, and that would have shown that Barry thought he fixed it, but actually he didn't, which is what happens in the Flashpoint comic, leading to the new 52.
Right.
And that would have shown that those characters would have continued on. And apparently there was also a version, Boris Kitt, the Hollywood Reporter, did a great report on the three different endings. There was also going to be a version where Carville was going to be there with them and Gal Gadot was going to be there with them. And that would have been, well, Carville's coming back. We saw him in Black Adam and he's going to be back. And we're going to have this combined universe where we're going to introduce people like Keaton, but we'll still have that Justice League that we know. And then the ending that we get instead has George Clooney step out of the car, which is really fun. And I, you know, I'm a big fan of that. But that was filmed 6 months ago and was very much under the James Gunn regime. So that kind of really, I think, confirms what you're saying there. Also, the big thing we haven't talked about, which absolutely did not work for me, and I actually have quite some moral issues with, how do you feel about those cameos?
Which ones?
In the Chrono Bowl.
Oh, so including, so...
So, okay, yeah. So we get some, okay, good point, right, actually.
Spoiler.
So we get some
which
funny...
Which ones?
So we get Wonder Woman Gal Gadot.
Yeah.
She comes, she helps save...
Very briefly.
We also get Temuera Morrison's Tom Curry. We see him on the phone. Yeah. And in that world, Arthur was never born, which is very interesting. It ties into the final stinger of the movie. But in the Speed Force, we... As Dark Flash is running around, they kind of do a cataclysm-esque thing. They do an anomaly-esque thing from Spider-Verse. And it's in the Chrono Bowl.
Barry is seeing all these different worlds now. He's really getting to, like, look into the world.
I guess they don't really explain it, but it looks like they're all going to collide into each other because of Dark Flash running through the Speed Force. Sure. But this is where you get those big cameos that they'd kind of been hyping up, that they were definitely leaking, that we were hearing people talk about from the preview screenings. And they're all, like, deep fake nightmares, in my opinion, including some that are literally like necromancy from bringing people back
in
from
the
dead.
Day. Now,
yeah,
this is a larger issue that is
moral issue.
This is a larger moral issue that is going to become ever more present with the evolution of technology like Midjourney and the ability to like bring formerly deceased actors back using their likeness.
We've seen it, you know, in Rogue One with Tarkin, and
we've seen it in commercials. I think that this is an issue of obviously like evolving law.
Mm-hmm.
And here's my issue with it. I think today, if I was an actor today and I was signing contracts and I like getting all the protections for my image and likeness, then I'd feel protected on that legal front. And then I'd have a conversation with my family, aka the estate, where I'd say, hey,
I'm okay with this.
Here is what I want for the future. I either want or don't want my likeness used for this, that, and the other. And that's, I think that is probably going to be standard and is something that's fine. I do have an issue with actors who passed away decades ago, had no idea about this technology, and who now are being, you know, resuscitated onto the screen in a project that they could not have even envisioned. Now, I guess there's an upside in which, you know, the family has a nice payday, I guess.
Hopefully.
But it feels off to me. It does feel weird because consent of the person should matter.
Yeah, I think as well, I think the reason that people have reacted so badly to it online, and I think the reason it didn't sit well with me is one, so the way that they showcase them, right, is almost like a movie reel, and it kind of like a film reel going around a world visually, like whatever. But you know what? You could have just used clips from the shows
from
and
the original
movies. I think that would have worked. You know, Adam West and Burt Ward, they loved their roles in Batman. That was something they were so proud of. So in that way, I feel like that kind of sits quite well. But as people online were pointing out, you know, George Reeves, who you see as, you know, he played Superman
very, very
in the
troubled
old serials, he killed himself.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that he killed himself was from the way that people report about it nowadays was because he was so depressed about being typecast as Superman. And the movie was released on the anniversary of his suicide, according to many angry people on the internet now.
George Reeves played by Ben Affleck in the movie Hollywoodland about
this kind of story, you know. And of course, Warner Brothers did not drop the movie on that day to do something cruel to George Reeves. But there is a lack of thought there that to people who care about that actor, who care about that story, it felt very cruel. Also, the one that I thought was quite shocking to me was to see them CG Christopher Reeves as Superman, and not only CG him, but CG him standing up. Now, Christopher Reeves, after he was paralyzed, became a very big advocate for disability rights, people who use wheelchairs. And he even had a cameo in Smallville where they had him with his breathing tube in the wheelchair because he wanted to be represented that way. And quite a few people online have pointed out that he, while he was alive, didn't want people to reuse old footage of him when he wasn't paralyzed because he wanted people to remember him how he was. I thought that was an example of a lack of thought that went into this. Also, Helen Slater, who played Supergirl in the much maligned but very fun Supergirl movie, she's still alive. Why wasn't she brought into the movie in some useful, impactful way, or even just seen kind of sitting, sipping a coffee in Metropolis at her age? There was a lack of humanity in those cameos, I felt like. Even Nick Cage, I love Nick Cage. Superman Lives, one of the greatest never made movies. Yes. I own photographs of Nick Cage in that suit. I want to see that movie. I was so excited to hear he was going to be in it. To me, I was shocked when I learned that they'd actually recreated the suit, as Andy Muschietti said, and they put him in it, because he was so de-aged, he was so CG'd, that I just assumed it was another kind of deep fake version. It didn't feel like they had brought Nick Cage in and given him that role. So for me, the cameos were something where if the joke turned me against, the mental health joke kind of turned me against it, by the end, even if I was kind of into some of the characters, those cameos, they left me feeling quite like, ugh. Like, they gave me the ick, you know? It was like, it was not a pleasant way to end the movie. Though, obviously, I love George Clooney Batman, so thanks for that one, James Gunn. Like, when he came, and he was looking great.
He was fun. I will say again, I do think that, I don't know the issues, the legal issue. I'm sure they had to negotiate with somebody, but it does...
They definitely did get... It's, apparently, they got family license.
It still is... It's definitely weird. And I will say that you also didn't need it.
You didn't need it.
You didn't really need it for the film.
It didn't make sense in the movie either. I didn't feel like there was a cataclysm or a multiversal collapse that was going to happen where you needed to see it. I feel like the intimacy that they created in this smaller... Yeah, there was a Zod battle, but it wasn't a huge deal. But that story, I know for you, for super producer Chris, like the things that hit was like Ezra and those the emotional beats that Barry had with his mom. You know, the relationship between Batman and Barry, Ben Affleck... as Batman getting to have this moment of saying, you need to explore this trauma. You need to not hide from it or run away from your past. The emotional, intimate beats, that was what people cared about and what I saw people saying that they loved. I don't think you needed that. I think that to me reeks of like execs who saw No Way Home was successful and were like, we need that. But like, it's so different to have a creepy CGI deepfake of a dead person like looking over a universe and to have Andrew Garfield stepping through like a sling ring portal.
Here is how I think something like that happens. And I can see the logic behind it, even if I disagree with the execution and including
it. Yeah, of course,
it,
of course.
In general. But I think the idea is, hey, we're Warner Brothers. We have this 100-year legacy of film excellence. And as part of that, as part of our lineage, is over half a century of a relationship with these iconic DC characters that stretches all the way back to the days of George Reeves and Christopher Reeves and et cetera. And why not highlight, isn't it a way to show how actually we're different than Marvel? They're kind of like the new kids on the block. Look at us. We go back to the 40s with our, you know, television executions of these characters. And it shows the breadth and the history of Warner's relationship with DC Comics. I think that that is the logic of it.
I agree.
Do I think that it should have been here? Probably not. I it felt superfluous to me. I didn't think you needed it.
You could have a moment where you're like showing a George Reeves Superman serial on the TV and then have Ben Affleck playing George Reeves talking to Barry. Like there's different ways you can do it if you want to do it. But I don't, like you said, when it happened, I actually had, by that point, I was like in watching the movie, right? So I wasn't waiting for the cameos. And when it happened, I was like, what happened?
To me, the big head scratch with that kind of cavalcade of characters is like, where's Wonder Woman? Where's
Linda Carter? Allegedly she got cut.
Where's Linda Carter?
But I think why?
That was like a long running, 3 seasons, I think, a television show that was a big deal.
And she was in Wonder Woman recently.
Yeah.
In the Wonder Woman 2 at the end. And she's still looking banging. She's still an icon.
Very, very bizarre to not have Wonder Woman in there.
She's another person who I feel like could have shown up in person.
Yeah.
You could put her in that suit nowadays. I've seen Linda Carter. She's still beautiful. Like, you could have had her there.
Linda Carter is kind of like the no-brainer, right? Like, even, like, I'm not gonna be like, oh my God, they forgot George Reeves. But I'm certainly like, where's Linda Carter?
they still show every single week. If you live in LA, if you have a broadcast antenna, if you don't have one, get one. They're great. Get an amplified antenna. It's like $30. Every Saturday morning on Heroes and Icons, they show and two episodes of
Wonder
Batman
Woman.
66, and then they show episodes of Wonder Woman. That still plays. People still watch that. Linda Carter is one of the most iconic superhero actors of all time. So I agree. That felt like a strange person to not include. Maybe Linda Carter didn't want to be CG'd up like that. She might not want it to be de-aged. Who knows?
But could have been.
Would have been nice to see her. Hopefully we'll see her again. What are your final takeaways from The Flash? Now you've seen it. It's done. It's come out. It didn't make a lot of money. We didn't talk about that.
Yeah, it's like a very, very average superhero film.
Yes.
There are some things I was surprised at, like how some of the emotional beats really worked. You know, Barry and Bruce is fun. There are really fun moments there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that the face-off with Zod, I thought Sasha's embodiment of Supergirl,
mm-hmm.
it felt emotionally rich for how little of that is in the film.
Mm-hmm.
It was doing a lot with a little, and really, this is what really made me feel like, you know, we could have gone faster with the exposition about Barry's mom and family mm-hmm. life. You could have just dropped into there and just like got it. Your mom was murdered. We all understand like that would be traumatic. And otherwise, like a middling film that was entertaining. I didn't feel bad that I saw it in the theater, that I think we will quickly move on from this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a closing of the chapter of this particular page of the DC universe, so that the James Gunn universe can be born. It was fine.
Yeah.
Better than Black Adam.
I agree. I like that that's like your baseline. I will say it did make $12 million less in its opening weekend than Black Adam. Think of that what you will. I think that speaks to the way that people don't necessarily think that this will have much of an impact yeah. because we have this new universe. I will say my biggest takeaway is I can't wait for Blue Beetle to come out. I'm very excited that James Gunn has confirmed that, you know, Jaime Reyes will be the first official character in his new DCU. So I really hope that people get excited to go and see that movie. I can't wait to see it. I'm excited to see a new generation of heroes leaning more into the comic books. I'm excited about all these Superman rumors that we're hearing. Boris Kitt shared some really fun ones. I would love to see Emma McKay as Lois Lane. I think David Corenswet would be a sick Clark Kent. He looks literally like him. Like, you know, I'm excited to be excited about these movies again. And I feel like The Flash is that end point. I love that it's connected. I had so many people DM me about this movie after they saw it and say, I loved it. I hated it. You know, I didn't feel any way about it. We always say this, if you love a comic book movie, I'm just happy that these movies are connecting with you. Go out, read the comics, find out what inspired
these
things.
Flashpoint is a fun read. An influential one.
Very influential. You're actually going to be, if you like Spider-Verse, the moment that we start our Flashpoint omnibus, you guys are going to be laughing.
Yeah.
Because the way this stuff is so cyclical, there is a word that I will say many times in my Flashpoint omnibus, and you guys will realize how much all of these stories live and breathe and learn and take from each other. But yeah, I agree with you. I think you summed it up perfectly. And I just can't wait to see what's next. I'm ready. I'm ready for August. I'm ready to be excited about DC.
Should we briefly talk about the Arthur Curry cameo and what that means?
Yes, I think it is worth talking about. So at the end of the movie, if you wait right till the end, there is one post-credits scene. Now, a lot of people have said it wasn't worth waiting for. It's just Jason Momoa and Barry, and they're kind of like messing around. And Arthur Curry is very drunk, as always. And he's kind of like in Central City. And he's you know, not feeling too great and everything. And he sort of falls into a puddle. But I actually think this is a very important bit of lore that they set up. Barry tells Arthur, in every universe I go to, in every timeline, in every version of the Speed Force, the world that the Speed Force takes me to, you are always you.
Yeah.
Barry says, I've seen other people. It was Bruce, but it wasn't Bruce. He was a different Bruce. I've been to these different places, and Bruce is always a different person. Superman didn't exist. Supergirl was there. But in every universe or multiverse or timeline that Barry goes to, Arthur is always Arthur, aka Arthur is always Jason Momoa. Now, I think that's very smart because as much as everybody maligns Aquaman, it's great. Sorry, guys. That movie is still the most profitable DC movie of all time. And Aquaman 2 is coming out at the end of the year. James Gunn has already said it counts as part of the DCU. And if that movie makes $1 billion, they don't want to have to cast Aquaman with a different actor.
Yeah.
So I think this essentially establishes the idea that if they want Jason to be in the DCU, the new DCU as it exists in the James Gunniverse, they have essentially established lore here that he could come back.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Up next, a return to the omnibus to discuss the comics origins of the Flash movie, Flashpoint.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep expert. Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus 2 free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
Welcome to another chapter in the Omnibus where lore, analysis, and understanding come together. This week, it's Flashpoint.
Ba, ba, ba.
We're doing it. We're talking about the absolutely groundbreaking, influential, I would say it's a crisis.
Yeah.
It was almost like an anti-crisis. It was exploding a universe out and bringing it back in all in one. And of course, like every comic book event, Flashpoint didn't begin or end with number one. You know, it began with many. There was a road to Flashpoint where Geoff Johns, Scott Collins, and Francis Manapole detailed the battle between the Flash and the Reverse Flash and kind of established a context for the scope of the world-changing event, which featured, you know, Bart Allen. And it featured a futuristic version of Barry Allen who came to stop what he called an anomaly. And the anomaly was a different version of the Flash who wasn't supposed to be in that timeline. And if you have seen Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, that will sound familiar. So the miniseries essentially ends on the anniversary of Barry's mum's death. And it's this really sad moment. And Barry promises his mum that soon everything will change. And then enter Flashpoint, which changes the DC universe forever. Before we really get into talking about Flashpoint, Jason, where were you the first time?
Oh, gosh.
Like, what's your first memory of reading Flashpoint?
It was like only maybe 4 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't keep up on the day-to-day, week-to-week with DC, but I always pick up like the big events.
Yeah.
Crisis, some of the new 52 stuff. Flashpoint was obviously a big one of them. Any of the kind of big Batman crossovers, because I read mostly DC through trades. So it was a few years ago and it was fun. The Flash is a character who I heavily Batman centric and Superman centric when I read DC. So I hadn't read much Flash and it was fun.
Yeah.
It was fun to get into.
For me, it was, I read it in the comic shop where I worked. There was a lot of quiet afternoons. Sometimes there you'd be there on a, you know, a Thursday or a Friday in the early afternoon. I read the whole thing in a trade. I was reading a lot of DC back then, catching up on a lot of stuff I hadn't really read or kept up with. And yeah, I remember it was just like a blockbuster kind of popcorn book.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really fun in the context of other crises, of this tradition that DC has of streamlining their multiple universes, the kind of sprawling canon that is created when you have hundreds and thousands of people writing books over 80 years. So
yeah,
it's a very fun, interesting book. And I'm not surprised that it is such a legendary title in comic books and also DC fans in general. I think just love this book. And I understand why some of them were disappointed that Flash wasn't more directly Flashpoint. But it's really interesting. It's an era-defining event. Geoff Johns wrote it, the main series, once you get into Flashpoint. Geoff Johns, the writer, Adam Kubert penciled it, legend. Sandra Hope and Jesse Delpadang were the inkers, Alex Sinclair colorist, and Nick Napolitano on letters. And it essentially, while fans didn't realize it at the time, its purpose was to reset the DC universe. Barry, as you pointed out when we were talking about the Flash movie, Barry wakes up at his desk and everything seems normal. He's been doing a long night of criminal forensics, as he does, and he discovers that when he wakes up, he's apparently in a different universe. They're talking about villains he's never heard of. Superman doesn't exist. Cyborg is the world's most famous hero, a Superman-level hero. There's no Justice League. And as he finds out when he falls down the stairs within the first pages of the book, he no longer has his powers.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. No ring, no suit, no powers. And just when things seem like they're getting really bad, something wonderful happens. And he bumps into his mum, Nora Allen, alive and in the flesh. She is no longer dead in this universe. She is alive. She's here. And she's come to see Barry. It's her birthday. She wants to go for dinner with her son. Where's his dad? No longer in prison. No longer died in prison, depending on the canon. He did sadly pass away 3 years ago from a heart attack, but they lived a happy life. And Barry is reeling, but there's one familiarity. And that's at least one of DC's Trinity is still around. Nora, no, she doesn't know Superman. She doesn't know Wonder Woman. Well, she might, but in a different way. But she does know Batman. Everybody knows Batman. But, and I will say, this is light spoiler territory, but I also feel like it's one of the most famous things that this comic does. So we'll talk about it a little bit. Batman is not the Batman that fans know and love here. And know to, you know, love to critique lovingly about his bad politics.
This is one of the cool, real cool shocks of Flashpoint.
Yeah. Flash is at this point, he is reeling, he's in this new world, but at least he knows Bruce. So he goes to the epic gothic halls of, you know, Wayne Manor. And we see this, they directly adapt that scene when in the Flash. And he gets there and he's calling for Bruce, but Bruce isn't there because in this timeline, as we will find out, Bruce was killed along with Martha and it was Thomas Wayne who survived. And because he lost his wife and his son, he becomes a Batman who kills. He becomes a Batman who is vengeful. As he meets Barry, he almost breaks his arm. He uses small joint manipulation to try and get information out of him. He is a brutal and violent man, devastated by the death of his family. And as we learn through a kind of Back to the Future-esque situation.
Yes.
Barry comes to realize while talking to Thomas that he is actually in his own world. He is not in a different universe. It's just that someone has changed the timeline. So all of these things are happening to Barry in his universe. And if he doesn't change them, he'll lose his memories. He'll lose the real timeline that he lived in. And he will never have his powers as a Flash. And that's kind of the big battle that we have to see him go on here. And it is just like a really interesting, bombastic book. And as you pointed out when we were talking about the movie, one of the coolest things about this is you do not find out the big reveal of this book until, like, you know, the fourth or fifth issue. This is a mystery. We see all these different cool versions. In this world, Aquaman and Wonder Woman are kind of warlords, and their battle against each other has caused this huge chaotic issue within global politics. We get to see Lois Lane as a kind of roving reporter, but also a spy. We get to see all these different fun versions. There's a really rad super team called the Resistance that are just totally out there. You know, it's like Grifter,
yeah,
all these different kinds of people. Steve Trevor, you know, fighting Wonder Woman. I imagine that as a creator, this is like one of the most fun books that you can write, where you can essentially just completely turn upside down everything we know about canon and just put these, you know, the toys that you get to play with, but you're putting them in totally different places on the chessboard.
Yeah, it was really fun. I mean, that's always been part of DC's DNA, you know, with these kind of like upside down.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Bizarro Superman, these kind of like crazy versions. But this was like a really unique take on it because it wasn't just like, oh, Wonder Woman's bad. There was like a real political reason that the Amazonians had seized the UK.
Yeah.
You know, there was like a wire war that while the main Flashpoint books don't really delve, they kind of like just touch on it. It's like background stuff. It is really interesting. Like I found myself being like, oh, I wonder what's going on there. That's really interesting. I'd like to know more about like what's going on with that.
Yeah, it's one of those events that actually makes you want to read all the one-shots and the...
Yeah.
A lot of times that can be something we complain about as comic book fans. Like you'll be loving an ongoing series and six issues in, suddenly you're just reading an issue that has nothing to do with anything in your book because it ties into a wider event. But this is one where if you read Flashpoint, you'll likely find the in to reading something else, to reading a one-shot, to reading a mini that led into it.
Yeah.
I think that if you're going to read this book, you don't have to read all four Road to Flashpoint issues, which were in the main Flash. But I would say, I believe that issue four is, it's like Flash issue 12 is the last part. And I would say definitely read that before you read Flashpoint. It makes everything make a lot more sense. But it's a really interesting, fun, weird take on the DCU. And you get this kind of like, it's the ultimate what if. You know, we love those kind of stories because the real truth is, even though it is not a major part of this story, and if you've seen The Flash, you will know what Superman's fate here is because they do this great... I loved, actually, that's something we didn't talk about. I thought it was really cool how they just did it with Kara instead of Cal, the same storyline.
Yeah, I thought that was great. I thought it actually kind of worked better, to be honest with you. It worked better in the movie than it did in the comic.
It worked. It was really cool. Yeah. But something that is cool that I like, because look, there's a few Superman comics that I love, like Superman for All Seasons and All-Star Superman and stuff like that. But it's not necessarily a character I have a deep investment in the way I do with some of the other characters. He's a little bit too, like, he's the good boy, he's the center. But what I do love about Superman is his inherent goodness and the way that goodness spreads. And what I love is this is essentially the biggest what if of what if Superman never landed and wasn't raised by the Kents. What if Superman never got to be the good blue-eyed boy of the DC universe? This is what happens. It all goes to shit. You need Superman there. You need his goodness. Otherwise, you're going to end up with these huge omnipotent beings fighting each other, these global super gods. And I thought that was just, I like that this book recognizes that, even though Superman is maybe in a few pages altogether. So I think it's really a very joyous read, and it's a very much of its time book. Like, if you read this, you feel like this book was made in 2011.
Tell us about how this leads into DC's line-wide reboot, The New 52, which was, you know, it's interesting how the big two copy and are inspired by each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think Marvel had just done, or was in the process of doing, the Heroic Age at that time. I might be wrong about the name of it, but they were also in the middle of a line-wide reboot. So it was a perfect, hey, time to jump on at a clear starting point for these two comics companies.
Yeah, and then Marvel saw the New 52 and did Marvel Now in 2012, which led to some of my favorite comics as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is really interesting. So the story ends in a almost... I feel like some may think it is abrupt, but there is essentially a double page spread near the end of the story that explains everything. This is the purpose of this book. This is the reason that Flashpoint exists. After a huge epic battle where some lives are lost and some people survive, Barry is inspired to go back in time and fix the mistake that he made, which, just like in the movie, is that he tried to save his mom. So he goes into the Speed Force, and instead of finding the Chronoball, he sees the hooded visage of Pandora, and he sees three different versions of the most famous superheroes from DC. And he learns that he can't just go back into the Speed Force and fix it because there's three timelines. There's not one timeline. And Pandora reveals, and this is very 2011 because everything's changed since then, but at some point in the past, the DC universe had been split into three timelines. DC's New Earth, which is what we knew as the main DC timeline, Earth 13, which at the time was basically seen as Vertigo, but is now understood to be a cult Earth with characters like Etrigan, and then supernatural characters like Sandman, and Vertigo characters like Hellblazer and Constantine. And 50, which is the Wildstorm universe, which we now know is coming really full force back into DC. So to fix his past choice, Barry has to essentially create a singular timeline. The time for three timelines is past. The singular timeline is going forwards. And the book ends with Barry delivering a letter to Bruce from his father, Thomas. And it seems like nothing has changed, but that double page spread essentially explains what is going to come next. And that is the New 52, where DC essentially stripped everything down, started every book from number one, and made a jumping on point for all characters where the canon before essentially didn't exist. Though obviously it did, because it inspired all the creators who made it, but it was essentially a new start. And it was a huge deal. And at first it was a huge boon to comic shops and sold very well. Lots of beautiful Jim Lee art to kind of showcase the story, but it actually didn't last that long. It would only be a few years before DC actually rebooted the universe again in Rebirth. I loved a lot of the stories from Rebirth. But yeah, it was really interesting. The New 52, it's still, I would say, rather infamous among fans because it was such a huge leap, and it all began with Flashpoint. So this is a super historical kind of thing. And the craziest thing is that Flashpoint has been adapted multiple times before The Flash. There's Flashpoint Paradox, one of the DCAU animated movies, which everybody loves. And it was also, no surprises,
yeah,
it was just regularly adapted throughout the CW Flash show. And that is something I also did kind of struggle with the movie. It's not that it's derivative, because it all comes from the same source point, but I did feel like a lot of the emotional beats and a lot of the ground that was covered in The Flash had already been covered in the CW, and I didn't necessarily feel like there was a lot of difference. In the show, just like the comics, Grant Gustin changed his timeline. He wanted to save his mom. And very much like The Flash, they didn't want to adapt this huge global war, so it focused on his intimate losses. It was very Back to the Future focused. Mm-hmm. Oh, you can't have Barry lose his connection with Iris. You can't have Barry lose his memories. And it was very interesting. That was the opening of season three that really focused on that. In season eight, ironically, they did a reverse Flashpoint with the reverse Flash. And that was much closer to the comic book version, with this kind of global war and Barry having to save the world. It was really interesting. And definitely, you can just jump in and watch those after you've read the comics to see all the different ways that this story's been adapted. And the Flashpoint Paradox is seen as one of the really great standouts of the DCAU, the animated universe. But all of those movies are great, so they're always worth watching.
Up next, more Omnibus with a discussion of Secret Invasion. Secret Invasion launching this week. By the time you hear this podcast, it's very likely that Secret Invasion on Disney Plus will be out.
Yeah, the first episode.
First episode will be out. So we thought it'd be the perfect time to talk about the comics origins of the Secret Invasion storyline. Now, a way to think about Secret Invasion, which first appeared June 8th, 2008 to January 2009, is in relation to all the other Marvel events that took place starting in the early 2000s. Now, this was a period in Marvel history where the company was just emerging from the kind of like business and creative doldrums spurred by their bankruptcy of the late 90s. And it was also a time that's kind of marked by the increasing influence and prevalence of the work of Brian Michael Bendis, who wrote the Secret Invasion, the main Secret Invasion storyline. Now, for me, this was a period when I was getting back into comics after like 3 years off. And it was also a time where it was like super fun to pick up these trades and kind of follow the evolution of Marvel Comics up through Secret Invasion.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me, this period of Marvel starts with Avengers Disassembled, which is 2004, kind of Brian's big swing in the Marvel universe proper.
Mm-hmm.
And this storyline is an exploration of yet another ending of the Avengers. So the Avengers are kind of destroyed in a shocking manner, which I will not outline because it is a really fun read. But the kind of takeaway is the Avengers are no more. And here is a Marvel Comics universe without the Avengers. The Avengers get back together shortly thereafter. Don't worry.
Of course, they always do. Don't worry.
But this is, again, this is 2004. And you get this very, what at least at the time for me was like this emotionally evocative, all the citizens of New York standing candlelight vigil with all their pictures of the Avengers, and they're standing in front of the Avengers mansion, and it really made you feel like, oh, this felt of a piece with this post 9/11 like Iraq tragedy world in which, oh my God, our heroes are gone. They get back together shortly after. Don't worry about it. That leads into 2005 House of M, of course, alternate universe in which the mutants win.
Iconic.
That is super fun. That all of these events, and what I think is really cool about these events, is they then would affect Marvel canon going forward into these other events, which was a really cool characteristic of them. That leads you to a decimation in which the reaction to House of M, right? In this alternate timeline, mutants are triumphant. It's, of course, put back together again and fixed by the efforts of various heroes, including Wolverine. And from there, you go to decimation where mutants are essentially wiped out. They're 198 mutants total left in the world after that. That leads us into Civil War 2006, the big...
Ever heard of it?
Ever heard of it? Big internecine battle between two sides of heroes. One side led by Iron Man feels like, hey, we got to register. We got to register our powers. Like, there's been too many times where, you know, the Hulk destroys Las Vegas, or the X-Men, you know, blow up a city, and people are tired of it. And shouldn't we register like a loaded weapon? And so this turns into the Civil War, where a whole group of the superhero community go underground, continue their superhero ways, but as essentially outlaws. Now, it's a good thing that the Hulk wasn't around for Civil War, even though he did kind of start it with his destruction of like an entire American city. And because of that destruction, he is launched into space, which gives us World War Hulk. When Hulk eventually comes back, he then beats up all the heroes that sent him away. And this and the fallout from Secret Invasion lead us into another paradigm. But let's talk about Secret Invasion. So Hulk comes back, he beats up all the heroes, and then Secret Invasion happens. Secret Invasion, on the heels of Civil War, was devastating because public trust in superheroes was already an all-time low. Then the Hulk beats the shit out of everyone and basically takes over the world for a period of time. And on top of that, we discover in Secret Invasion that not only are the heroes extremely fallible, but many of them were Skrulls.
Yeah, this is, I would say this is like the biggest thing that I remember about Secret Invasion that I think was so impactful. It's really interesting. We talked about Flashpoint. That very much felt like, it's a fun, it's bombastic, but it feels like kind of like a corporate edict book. Like, you know that the world needs to be reset. It doesn't necessarily have a lot of the lead in.
You're exactly right. That's a good point.
Like, this does. I mean, you're talking about most of the big events. You could just read like Civil War. You could read Annihilation. You could read World War Hulk. Then you could read Secret Invasion, and you'd kind of have like a domino effect of understanding. What I remember about Secret Invasion, the marketing for this book is...
It was really good.
Among the best marketing for any story ever. This is my biggest complaint to Marvel Studios. Why they are not doing a who do you trust marketing campaign?
They apparently did send Skrulls out to various locations, but that's, yeah.
Oh, that's good. That's fun. But like, so every shop you go into, every comic you're reading, it says, who do you trust? Who do you trust? Who do you trust? And they start laying the groundwork for that huge reveal that you mentioned, which is that these characters you love for like 30 years, guess what? Some of them are Skrulls, and they've been Skrulls the whole time. You don't know them. Some of them have been Skrulls so long that they don't even know they're Skrulls. Like, it was so good. And the idea of who do you trust, and the conversation everybody's having is, who's a Skrull? Who's a Skrull? Who's a Skrull? Who do you think's a Skrull? It is just so cool. And not only that, but this is like you mentioned Byron Michael Bendis, but the main Secret Invasion arc is like a superstar team. Leno Francis Yu, one of the best artists to ever do it.
One of our great Filipinos working in comics.
By the way, one of the most influential communities in comics, full stop. Wills Portacio, so many icons. But like Mark Morales is inking it. You got Laura Martin on colors. This is an all-star team. It's not just a great story, but it is a beautifully made comic. Like, and I just remember that Who Do You Trust was so, so much in that space and that conversation. Who is a Skrull? Which one of the heroes that you love? Who's your favorite who you can no longer trust? It's so clever.
And I will say, in a world in which the bad guys often have terrible plans, the Skrull plan is actually really good. You mentioned...
It's really good.
I'll name the one that kind of kicked off the hero's awareness that something was afoot, and that is the realization that Elektra has been a Skrull for an unknown amount of time since she came back from the death, maybe the whole time, like unclear.
Seems like Skrull technology could be good for bringing someone back from the dead, just saying.
And the realization that Elektra was a Skrull sets off other realizations that, one, Stark Tech cannot detect Skrulls any longer, neither can Fantastic Four Tech. Mm-hmm. Logan couldn't smell her as a Skrull. So the Skrulls have figured something out that has allowed them to really potentially burrow deeply into the human halls of government. And they don't wait. This is a real Pearl Harbor type plan. Like, once all the stuff starts happening, it escalates very, very quickly from...
The Skrulls have been planning for a long time. They're ready.
Yeah, it escalates very, very quickly from like a big fight in the Savage Land with Skrull doppelgangers of some of your favorite heroes fighting the legitimate articles to invasion of Earth by massive Skrull forces. And that gets really fun. Now that, I won't tell you how that pans out. It's only an 8-issue arc with various other tie-ins. You don't really need to read the tie-ins.
No, I will say the one that I think is worth reading, not for context, but just because it is one of the best Black Panther comics of all time, is the Black Panther
yes.
tie-in comic by Jason Aaron. We've talked about that a lot. See Wakanda and Die.
Yeah.
Is very, very cool. And I just love, for me, that's like a very cool, fun tie-in. And it's the only one. It's Hefte Palo was the penciler. That's the only one where I think you should just read it for fun. And it's like 3 issues. But otherwise, you're right. This is the core story. You can just read it and enjoy it.
So if you're going to read Secret Invasion again, I would say get on at least its Civil War and then go up,
mm-hmm.
because I think it's important to understand that context.
I like that.
But you could go all the way back to Disassembled. And then coming out of Secret Invasion, so the heroes do, the invasion is rebuffed, but in a world in which the trust in heroes was already at an all-time low, and the fact that, you know, Captain America died at the end of Civil War and his own storyline that kind of branched off from Civil War. And so there's this real feeling of the heroes have blown it. We've given them our trust.
Mm-hmm.
We've tried with them. And all we get are them fighting each other and like an alien invasion that we only caught because of like luck. That springs us into Dark Reign, which we've talked about a lot, which was this seemingly harebrained idea of why don't we give Norman Osborn a shot to run everything? Which sounds great, right? Like that sounds crazy to just say, hey, let's give the Green Goblin the reins and let, but because of all of this work that starting from Disassembled all the way up, where you're just seeing the heroes, they win, but they are like long range kind of losing because people are just like, you guys aren't really winning in the way you used to. It makes Dark Reign really make sense. Like,
yeah.
And you said something that I really like, which I hadn't really thought of, which was Flashpoint seemed like a corporate edict. Like, hey, we need to bring in the new 52. Let's figure out a way we can do it. Now,
mm-hmm.
Marvel does this too. There's a million.
Oh, it happens all the time.
The original 80s Secret War.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The toys.
Was, if nothing, then a corporate plan to sell toys. But what's really cool about this era of Marvel Comics up to Dark Reign was it really just kind of felt like, hey, you know what would be cool coming out of this? What if Norman Osborn won? So if you're planning on reading Secret Invasion, it naturally leads you into Dark Reign, which is a thing you might want to read.
So fun.
Now, last year, they gave us a 5-issue limited series called Secret Invasion, not part two, just Secret Invasion once again. Now, this is the new retelling of a different event, which seems, we haven't seen Secret Invasion, the show yet, but this seems like very much a primer slash soft tie-in to the show because it has a much smaller scope and is focused on a much smaller coterie of characters, written by Ryan North with art by Francesco Mobili. Wonderful cover artists, various cover artists. So in the wake of the original Skrull invasion, we learn in 2022 Secret Invasion that the Skrulls are back. They're here again. But it's not quite what you think. Maria Hill is the director of the CIA. S.H.I.E.L.D. has been dismantled. Does sound familiar, right? And Nick Fury is just kind of like a security consultant, like this font of wisdom. Like, obviously, Nick Fury's seen it all. And if you have questions about, like, how AI could potentially become sentient and threaten the world, or what happens if Stark Tech gets out, of course, you're going to call Nick Fury and you're going to get him involved. Well, in his capacity as this kind of independent security consultant, Nick investigates what is thought to be evidences of a Skrull invasion in the Midwest. And then he goes to Maria Hill and says, guess what? I checked it out. It was nothing. But Maria, because she and Nick have this long running relationship and have thought of like all these different ways in which the world could go badly, they have like all of these security phrases for each other. So she tests Nick, who's telling him, yeah, I checked out that thing and it's fine. No Skrulls involved. She gives him the passphrase, which he doesn't know. And that lets her know that, guess what? Nick Fury has been replaced by a Skrull. And it turns out all these other important people, but not like important people in the government.
But not superheroes.
Not superheroes have been replaced by Skrulls.
I think that's very relevant.
That's very relevant, right? So that sounds like a lot like what the show is going to give us. But this time, and I won't spoil it too much, what's happening is not a hardcore, aggressive Skrull invasion with attack ships and transports and, you know, this very, very elaborate ruse. What's happening is an internecine battle between these kind of like Skrull extremists who believe that Earth needs to be wiped out. And yes, we've been trying and yes, we've failed, but we figured out a kind of smarter way to do it this time. And a sect of Skrulls who think, you know what? This is crazy. The Skrull Empire is multiple worlds. Like, it's not just like one core homeworld. There's a lot of, there's an empire. And a kind of more human-leaning sect of Skrulls who think, no, we shouldn't be doing it this way. And in fact, maybe there's a way that Skrulls and human superheroes can collaborate, much to the success of both parties. Like, maybe Skrulls and humans can benefit from an alliance of Skrull and humans. Now, can the Skrulls be trusted? This is what this Secret Invasion 2022 explores. And I, though it goes a long way towards selling you on, yeah, maybe some of these Skrulls can be trusted. It does feel like it also sets up, can they? but if you want to check out the 2022 Skrull Invasion of Earth, Secret Invasion, again, not part two, just called Secret Invasion once again.
Classic Marvel tradition.
Classic Marvel tradition. Check that out. It's only 5 issues. It's really fun. And it feels like a direct tie-in to...
I think it's seeding.
Yeah.
It's definitely seeding this kind of smaller scale. Also, I will say, Ryan North, writer of The Unbeatable Squirrel yes. Girl with Erica Henderson, which is like one of the best Marvel comics ever. So definitely check it out.
She's an important part of this,
of course.
Of this version of the Secret Invasion.
Maybe we'll finally get her in the MCU. But yeah, these are... We truly have been blessed. Like, something that I love about the way you approach this omnibus is like, there have been so many great Marvel events. And when you think about them, you're like, there are so many that I just want to go back and pick up a trade of. I love Dark Reign. I love Annihilation.
Dark Reign was really cool.
I love Dark Reign is so fun. Also, it's hard to get into without spoilers, but like that first Secret Invasion book, you are talking about, if you have a favorite Marvel character, they are in it.
Oh, everybody's in it.
I'm not going to say whether they're a Skrull or not, but like, it opens and you have a version of the Illuminati. You're talking about A-level A-star famous Marvel heroes throughout that whole event. Every single hero you like, every single team, they are involved. It is like an ultimate blockbuster.
So many are involved that they go deep. I mean, this is a period of time, again, where post-Civil War, right, you had two factions. You had the Mighty Avengers, who were like the government-branded, licensed Avengers team.
Yeah.
Captain Marvel, Iron Man, others. And then you had the kind of like secret Avengers, who were the underground team that refused to sign the papers to get the licenses. And that's Power Man, Wolverine, Spider-Man.
The bad boys.
The bad boys. And then you had this entire, you know, speaking of how deep the roster goes, you had this entire 50 states initiative where the government was like trying to replace all the heroes who went AWOL because they didn't want to sign, and was signing up heroes in every single state. And so you had those 50 state initiative, like, just got their license to drive heroes involved in this battle.
I'm going to tell you this. Two things I love about Secret Invasion that I do hope are brought into the show. I feel like it's unlikely, but in Secret Invasion, one of the big tells that somebody is a Skrull is that they eat strawberries and pickles because it tastes like a Skrull snack. So keep an eye out if you watch it on Wednesday, see if anyone eats a pickle and a strawberry, or even just a pickle or a strawberry, they're probably a Skrull. And my other thing, speaking of deep cut rosters, is the importance of a character named 3D Man. If you have listened to the podcast before, you know I'm a 3D Man fan. I hope that we end up in a world where there's some kind of version of that him and his role in the story, which is so fun. So it's just such a fun story. I'm very interested when we have both watched Secret Invasion, which will be our, you know, our episode that comes out on Friday. I'm very excited to talk about it because I feel like I'm remembering how much I love the comic and I know it's going to be different. So I'm just excited to have that conversation.
Up next, Nerd Out.
In this week's Nerd Out, where you tell us what you love and why, a theory you're excited to share, or a quick question we can answer, which is exactly what's going to happen this time around, Homer asks a multiversal query about the MCU.
Here's Homer. Hey, sorry if this is a basic question, but in Marvel movies and comics, what's the difference between a universe, a dimension, and a timeline? It seems the Loki, Spider-Man, and Doctor Strange shows movies all seem to use different items. Are they different concepts or interchangeable words with the same meaning? Great question.
I was going to say, it seems like a basic question, but it is not a basic question because I actually think that is an ultimate storytelling question that comes out of the fact that you have multiple different people telling these stories and people will say different things about universes, dimensions, timelines. They are not all the same, but they can be used interchangeably. That's how I would explain it.
They are broadly interchangeable, but which term is used depends on how deeply we're going to explore that particular timeline, dimension, or universe.
And also, I think the difference, the main difference is a new timeline can create a new universe or dimension, but universes and dimensions can exist already without being created by a new timeline.
That's essential. Thanks, Homer. If you have theories or passions you want to share, hit us up at xray@crooked.com. Instructions in the show notes. That's it for us. Rosie, any plugs?
You can find me here twice a week. You can find me on Letterboxd, Rosie Marks, Instagram, Rosie Marks. You can read some articles I've been writing and check out my Substack called Rosie Recommends, where I just recommend cool books and comics.
Catch the next episode of X-Ray Vision Friday, June 23rd for the premiere of Secret Invasion on Disney+. Plus, X-Ray Vision is recording a live episode on June 26th in which we will be discussing the 15th anniversary of the release of The Dark Knight in theaters. If you can't make it in person but still want to watch live, go to crooked.com/events and scroll down to the X-Ray Vision section to get your ticket.
And you can subscribe on YouTube where you can find full episodes of the show. Check out the Discord to meet and hang with tons of amazing fans and me and Jason.
Yay! Five-star ratings, five-star reviews.
Five.
Need them. We got to have them. You got to give it to us. Here is one from Ashvez84. Rosie and Jason are so fun and entertaining. Thank you. I'm not even a big comic sci-fi person, and I still listen because they are that good. Very appreciate their inclusivity and how they make everything so easy to understand. Rosie knows everything. Strong agree.
Ah, thank you.
See you next time.
Bye.
X-Ray Vision is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Chris Lord and Saul Rubin and executive produced by me, Jason Concepcion. Our editing and sound design is by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Video production by Dylan Villanueva and Rachel Gajewski. Social media by Awa Okolati and Caroline Dunphy. Thank you to Brian Vasquez for our theme music.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Tired of restless nights? At Leesa, we know good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. From memory foam mattresses to hybrids that keep you cool all night long, Leesa's mattresses offer exceptional comfort and support with free delivery and 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to leesa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. Exclusions apply. See leesa.com for more details.